Switches. Western New York, Timeline 3, May 2020. They were out of the side door as soon as the Rotodyne stopped bouncing on its shock absorbers. The rotor disc high overhead was still shrieking as a squad of Commonwealth guards rushed them to a squat blockhouse, checked their IDs, and led them into an elevator. The door concertinaed shut just as the aircraft began to spool up again, vacating the pad to make way for the next aircraft to land under the barrels of the point defense guns. There was nothing terribly subtle about the redoubt, where the first man and half the cabinet would take shelter from the gathering nuclear storm. Thousands of tons of concrete and rebar had been poured into a hole in the ground, forming a cradle around a sunken bunker that sat atop a platform suspended on huge shock absorbers. Nearby hills supported a forest of antennae. Radar dishes twirled continuously overhead, tracking everything in the sky and feeding constant updates to the guns and missile batteries emplaced around the headquarters. But the redoubt had one unique twist that placed it in a class of its own, unlike anything ever built in the United States by anyone except the Klan. The entire four-story command complex sat atop an air cushion, and hollow doppelganger redoubts, identical, save for a hole, in place of the command complex, had been built in three neighboring empty timelines. With a world walker permanently on station, ready to move the entire core of the redoubt to safety, there was no need to drill a cathedral-sized bunker under Cheyenne Mountain for protection from a hard nuclear rain. Only a first strike, executed in parallel in multiple timelines, would stand a hope of succeeding. Or so the designers hoped. Over her years in government, Miriam had developed a bitter hatred for nuclear command bunkers. She'd spent more than her fair share of time holed up in them, taking her turn as Commissioner for Continuity of Government, a euphemism for Queen of the Smoking Aftermath, in her opinion. Bunkers stank of failure. They smelled metallic, their bottled air pumped through particle filters and monitored by Geiger counters. The corridors were unpleasantly narrow and the ceilings low, the walls painted a nauseous mustard yellow, and the floors battleship gray. Hard, narrow bunk beds, space being at a premium, and ill-lit, cramped meeting rooms surrounded by men and, increasingly these days, women, with drawn face and bags under their eyes, all of them hoping that the axe wouldn't fall. Even if they survived, their families would be left behind on the surface. The first man's redoubt was larger, but no different in kind. So at 9 o'clock, with only a couple of hours' sleep behind her, Miriam found herself bellied up against a conference table, with her back almost touching the wall behind her. She was drinking bitter coffee and reading a steady stream of incoming reports in the vain hope of staying alert in a meeting room full of People's Party commissioners and general staff officers waiting for Sir Adam to arrive. The door opened. A woman in the uniform of one of the nursing orders shuffled in backward, pulling a wheeled chair. Miriam blinked her eyes into focus before she recognized the hunched figure within. She glanced sideways, caught Erasmus's shocked look, and rapidly suppressed reaction.
"Good morning, everybody,"
husked the first man as his nurse turned him to face the table. His smile was watery, his skin sallow and drawn tight across the bones of his face.
"I see we are all present and correct."
Miriam forced her hands into immobility to avoid betraying herself by raising them to her mouth in shock. She had last seen Adam 4 weeks previously. He'd been walking then, clearly increasingly frail, but not exceptionally so. She'd read the carefully coded memo. The first man is not currently accepting new public engagements due to nervous exhaustion. He sends his best wishes and urges everyone to carry on regardless. But this wasn't nervous exhaustion. Sir Adam looked at her, and for a moment his gaze carried its old weight, striking like a rod of iron. But then he faded as she watched.
General Josephus, your latest update, please.
Certainly, sir, said Josephus, his delivery polished. Current prevailing winds are blowing northeasterly off Cape Cod, and as you know, the Zeus 4 petard was designed to produce little radiative residue. So the fallout plume is blowing offshore. Unfortunately, this means that the French will detect it within 4 days, possibly sooner if their spy trawlers on the Grand Banks are equipped with detectors. Even if they didn't spot the first light, this will provide confirmation of an airburst off our coast. We therefore anticipate increased French diplomatic and espionage activity within the week, even in the absence of other engagement.
What about the target?
Asked Sir Adam.
Is anything known about it?
We can't be certain, sir. There is only a very remote possibility that the French have acquired the capability to build something like this. Coming 2 weeks after the previous US intrusion, confirmed from the wreckage, we can reasonably assume that they have upped the ante. Published sources suggest that the target matched the profile of a Tier 3 unmanned autonomous drone, a long-range, high-altitude strategic reconnaissance probe.
Thank you, General. Mrs. Burgesson, do you have any insights?
Sir Adam stared at her, his head lolling slightly to one side. Weak neck muscles, she noted. Generalized cachexia. Muscle wastage. Looks like stage 4. Probably liver or pancreatic cancer. Oh, shit.
Miriam?
She blinked. I'm sorry, she said automatically. If it isn't the United States, we've had the supreme misfortune to have come to the attention of another Class 2 paratime civilization at the worst possible moment. But it's almost certainly the United States. Their standard protocol seems to be to send over a black box, just to check for atmosphere on the other side. Then a medium-altitude mapping drone. Air Defense Command shot down the first, so a week later they sent another. It's not unknown for them to malfunction or crash. But ADC shot down the next one, and 2 hull losses on consecutive flights are statistically improbable. So this time they sent a bigger, faster, higher-altitude drone with wide-angle cameras. She knuckled her tired eyes. And ADC, bless their little cotton socks, shot it down again. So if they didn't know we were here before, they certainly do now. She looked round at a circle of dismayed faces. The good news is, we're still alive, she said. Either they're off balance or they're not on a war footing at all. We have some breathing space, although I have no idea how much. Sir Adam opened his mouth. For a moment she was terrified that he would be unable to speak, but after a false start, almost a stutter, he followed through.
I will not order a preemptive strike by means of capital weapons.
He spoke into the sudden silence.
None of the reports I have read from the DPR suggest that their current president is a sociopath. I expect her to behave similarly.
Sociopath was one of the most useful concepts that Miriam's Mimetic Engineering Task Force had imported from the United States. Erasmus's propaganda ministry had been working overtime to raise awareness of it as an anti-democratic problem. People who think people are things. Sometimes she thought that educating the Commonwealth about social psychology and teaching them about cognitive biases, authoritarian personality types, and game theory had done more good than all the STEM research they'd imported. Enlightenment was an uphill struggle, but if it reduced the likelihood of wars and reigns of terror, it was well worth the cost. Miriam cleared her throat.
They tried it on the Grunmarkt, she said. It didn't succeed. Scott Schroeder, the Assistant Commissioner for Defense, snorted.
Obviously, they should have tried harder.
Miriam looked at him sharply for a moment, trying to discern any hint of ironic intent.
Just playing devil's advocate,
he added. Miriam shook her head. Imagine if the French dropped a megaton range capital weapon on this bunker right this second, killing us all, Sir Adam included. Eyes instinctively turned to the invalid. He watched them right back, calculatingly passive, guarding his remaining vitality. How exactly would our people respond?
They'd... Schroeder stopped. I take your point. The United States started out as a revolutionary republic, just like our Commonwealth,
Sir Adam said, a faint smile tugging at the corners of his sunken eyes.
They may have succumbed to the twin corruptions of oligarchy for the elite and bread and circuses for the masses, but their deep state still has sinews of steel. Moreover, their form of government is extremely resilient. They are no more capable of surrendering than we are. War is unthinkable. If it is unleashed, the conflagration will spread until all are consumed.
He paused for a few seconds.
As you can see, I am indisposed.
He looked at them across the table, deliberately making eye contact.
So I delegate this task to you who are assembled here. You are to devise a strategy for engaging directly with the government of the United States. I want you to lock them into a dance of... I believe the term they will understand is mutually assured destruction.
He smiled directly at Miriam, a fey, frightening expression.
It will give them the comfort and certainty of a well-thumbed rule book for avoiding the Holocaust. And then...
He paused for a few more seconds until Miriam was about to ask his nurse to intervene.
Once the immediate situation is stabilized, you are to investigate ways and means of bringing democracy to the United States of America.
Philadelphia, Timeline 2, August, 2020.
Rita's first foray to the switchyard had taken place at 3:15 a.m. on a Thursday. It had taken 6 minutes, and she'd spent the next 6 hours being debriefed no less than 3 times, first by Patrick, and then over a secure video link by Colonel Smith and a tired-looking posse of senior agents, all of whom were presumably going to brief their various superiors over the following days. Then they stuck her in a box with a tablet while she wrote up everything she remembered. A transcript of this would be carefully embalmed with the telemetry dumps from the equipment she'd been wearing. It would then be buried so deep in the Office of Special Programs vaults that she herself wouldn't be able to retrieve it. One committee briefing would inevitably lead to another, and by the time the ripples had spread out into the organization, it was Friday lunchtime. The head scratching over when to schedule her next jaunt to the switchyard then commenced. If it had been up to Rita, she'd have gone back over in the small hours of Friday morning, but Patrick told her that the colonel couldn't authorize another trip without obtaining a consensus from his supervisors.
The Black Rain discovery has rattled teeth all the way up to cabinet level. He wanted to send you out tonight, but he's got the Homeland Security Council breathing down his neck. OSP doesn't usually get this level of oversight, much less at his level.
He's a colonel, isn't he? Rita frowned. I thought that was pretty senior. She trailed off.
He's not a colonel. He's a retired colonel, Patrick said.
He paused to take a mouthful of coffee. He winced. Too hot or too bitter?
A colonel would be a pretty junior officer to be running this sort of operation. Colonels usually command a battalion or an Air Force squadron. Eric isn't a colonel. He's a spook. And it's all alphabet soup.
He may have started out in the Air Force, but he moved sideways into NSA, was assigned to the FDO in the early days. FTO became the OSP, OSP did a reverse takeover of the DHS, and then he set up the unit as his personal project. That's us. The human intelligence arm within what used to be the OSP, which used to be the FTO, which is what happened when the federal government discovered parallel universes and went WTF. Colonel was his rank when he retired from the Air Force. These days he punches above Major General. Rita shook her head.
So he's called a colonel but is actually a Major General?
Never mind. Patrick grinned suddenly. Don't worry about it. Let's just say he's extremely senior. This started out as his personal hobby horse, but it suddenly attracted the attention of a lot of even more senior people in the administration. He's not going to risk giving anyone an excuse to take his toy away from him. So nothing is going to happen before Monday. Hurry up and wait, in other words. You might as well take the weekend off. I'll clear it for you. You've earned some downtime.
Rita yawned. I'm in the wrong time zone, she complained. My family are in Phoenix. Most everyone I know is in Cambridge, and I'm stuck in a motel in Allentown. What am I going to do?
Go get some beauty sleep, then pretend you're a tourist visiting exotic Philadelphia.
I guess.
Rita drove back to the motel, lost in thought. Back in her room, she started by phoning her parents. Her usual weekly sonar ping was rendered slightly stilted by the certainty that everything she said would be transcribed and forwarded to whoever the colonel had assigned to monitor her. She'd been on the inside of DHS for only a matter of weeks, but that was enough to be certain that there was no way in hell an organization like the unit would trust a newbie like her with a key technology like Jaunt Blue without putting her under surveillance. It was probably Gomez, she guessed. Gomez was a hard-assed bitch and had been on her back since the beginning. If not Gomez, then Jack, the good cop to Sonya's bad cop.
Your grandfather's here,
River told her when the idle big sis little brother chat began to bore him.
Want to talk to him?
Yeah. Hi, Gramps.
Hello, Rita. Are you well?
He asked gravely.
I'm fine. Work's fine, she said happily. I can't talk about it, though.
Talk was their prearranged code word. It meant everything was indeed fine. Discuss, in contrast, meant send help. And mention was not to be mentioned save in extremis.
That book you lent me was weird. Are there any others like it?
They chatted about trivia for another 5 minutes, until Kurt tired.
Why don't you look up your old school friends? See if anyone lives nearby, he asked. I'm tired. I need my nap.
Yes, Gramps, I'll do that, she said, and hung up.
Hearing Mom and Dad and River and Gramps' voices had given her a brief boost, but the chill of isolation began to descend again. Rita could feel alone in the middle of a crowded party. Being stuck in a hotel room in the middle of nowhere with a bugged phone and monitored internet feed was beyond lonely. Catch up on friends, indeed. She hit Facebook, skidding across the frozen river of all the lifelines she'd crossed.
Do I know anyone who lives in Allentown? She wondered.
A quick search later, the answer came back. To her surprise, she did have a friend in Philly, and it was Angela, of all people. Or rather, Angie. She'd suddenly acquired a serious hate on her name. When? When she was 15? Rita hadn't seen Angie since they'd been in the Girl Scouts in Massachusetts, a decade ago. They hadn't been very close at first, but they'd done a couple of the special summer camps the parents of girls in Wolf Troop sent them to, the ones with the language courses and orienteering and the other stuff. Then teenage kicks and tentative self-discovery happened, and for a year they'd been inseparable. Not to mention fizzing bundles of anxiety at the possibility that one of their schoolmates might see them together and realize what they were to each other. This was back during the second Rumsfeld administration, when Congress was busy defending marriage from girls like them. It had fizzled out tearfully when Angie's folks had stayed in Boston and Rita's moved to Phoenix. But Angie herself had enlisted, and then somehow ended up here. And she was on chat. Rita procrastinated for almost a quarter of an hour. There were idiotic arguments to chip in on, after all, and 5 things she really needed to know about vaping that would totally change her life, and sundry clickbait to distract from the burning question, how will she remember me? Angie's face had sat frozen in her FB feed for years, unlooked at. Rita couldn't bear to think of herself as a stalker. It was undignified and creepy, but also undeleted. And Angie didn't update her wall very often, anyway. Like Rita, she clutched a thick veil of privacy tight around her online life. But here she was, online for a chat, and nearby, not thousands of miles away. Finally, Rita ran out of excuses. This is stupid, she told herself. She'll have found herself a cute blonde, settled down, and forgotten me. Or somehow, while she was spinning her gears, her fingers began to move without her conscious volition. Hi, Angie. Rita? Been ages. Sup, sis? I'm in Allentown. Work. Weekend. Bored. Work? Permanent? Temp. Want to meet up? Love to. When, where is good? Let me get back to you. Free tonight? Feeling unaccountably hot and prickly, Rita stared at her phone for a minute. Angie seemed enthusiastic. Come to think of it, when had she last followed her? Angie lived so far away there hadn't seemed to be much point. She looked at Angie's profile status, single again, and bit her lip before replying. Yes, hot! Share your location, and I'll be round at 8. Yes. Later, smiley face. Oh my God, Rita thought dizzily. She hoped Angie wouldn't get the wrong idea. It had, after all, been a very long time. Philadelphia, Timeline 2, August, 2020. Rita had gotten close with Angie when they were both in 10th grade. Gawky teens trying to figure out what interested them in life. They were both going through that phase of working out whether to try and scrape together the money to study or to get a job right away, not to mention whether they were interested in boys or not. Rita, not so much. Although shy and introspective, she'd been unsure how her parents would cope if they found out. A misplaced fear, as she subsequently learned. Angie? Back then, she'd been a strawberry blonde with a bob and a smile, as devoutly Lutheran as her parents. Grandpa Kurt and Angie's parents shared a history back in the GDR that the girls were supposed to ignore, and for the most part, they successfully did. When they'd first spent time together at summer camp, Rita had pegged her for a boy chaser who'd be married by 20 and pregnant by 21. Then Rita had learned just how wrong first impressions could be, in a good way. Angie's eyes were still blue and twinkled like the iridescent sheen on her nose stud and eyebrow rings, but her hair was cuprous green streaked with blue, and she walked with a swagger. Rita managed not to gape when she saw her across the hotel lobby. Angela? She called, momentarily forgetting. So much for the demure girl she remembered from high school days. On the other hand, Rita had been far from the only one who'd been kept in the closet for fear of bullying in the coldly repressive climate of the early 2010s. Times had changed. And in any case, the whole wide world was not a high school diner, and Angie had blossomed. It's Angie, remember? Angie hugged her. And a 5 merit point fine every time you forget. You're looking gorgeous. Have you eaten? No? Let's roll then. Angie's wheels were recent enough to drive themselves, with a truck top and a fire-red paint job. You're looking good, too, Rita said, trying to fill the silence. Been keeping well? It was hard at first, but I got my certification 2 years ago. You would not believe how much work there is for an electrical contractor in this town. Chariot, drive us to Emma's. Listen, Rita. The pickup's engine lit with a whine as it backed and turned out of the narrow parking lot, and Rita noticed to her confusion that they were still holding hands. How did we even get in the truck? You never called? Never even sent me a selfie bug? Rita swallowed. I wanted to, but it kept getting harder the longer I waited. Then my folks moved and your folks moved. Angie leaned across the bench seat and turned Rita's face to hers and kissed her as if to hit undo on the last decade. You do not leave it 10 years next time, girl. I didn't mean to. Where are we going? The best gay bar in town, not that there are many to choose from out here in the sticks. Unless you're... No, I'm fine. She tossed her head. She caught Angie's eye. There's a lot of catching up to do. And I was hoping for somewhere private. Really? That smile. Chariot, make all windows opaque. Angie's thumb clicked on her seatbelt button as the outside world dimmed to night. Then the thumb clicked on Rita's belt button. Will this do? Rita made a quiet eep of assent as Angie scooted sideways toward her. Then they kissed again as the steering wheel spun unattended. Philadelphia, Timeline 2, August 2020. Much later, after dinner and drinks and dancing and a drunken auto ride home, they sat together naked in the middle of Angie's bed as Angie rolled another joint. Rita traced her finger across the tentacles of the Hokusai octopus. They trailed from its bulbous body centered on Angie's left shoulder, coiling around her ribs, and rose to cup the underside of her right breast. She was luminous with sweat and sweetly aromatic with the new mown hay aroma of marijuana. I feel like I've been living in a coffin for months, Rita said softly. Too much work and no play makes... Her fingertip lingered at the crinkling, stiffening edge of Angie's areola, then gently nudged the silver barbell. Too much of that and I'll spill the bud, girl. So I'll have to lick it off you? So what? Rita leaned against Angie, like this. She demonstrated. Angie tensed. You never did say what brought you to town.
Work.
Rita paused.
I don't want to talk about it.
Angie raised the open cone to her mouth, ran her tongue along the seam of the papers.
If it's such a shit job, why don't you quit? Angie asked as she rolled it between her palms.
I'm not sure it's the kind of job I can quit.
Mob?
Angie asked softly.
Because if so, listen, I know a cop who... It's not like that. I work for the DHS now. I'm not at liberty to discuss it.
Oh.
Angie fell silent for a minute, until the gathering sense of dread nearly convinced Rita that she'd confessed to something inexcusable. Working for the man. They both understood. It was expected of them. Like marriage and babies to so many other young women. But even so...
Okay.
Angie's tone fell oddly flat. Thought I'd heard the end of that when I got out of the army.
Phone.
What?
Phone.
Rita looked over the edge of the bed, picked up her purse.
What?
Give it here. Angie took it, flipped it upside down and popped the battery.
Glass?
Don't wear it.
Okay.
Angie reached over her side of the bed and picked up her own phone. She held it where Rita could see it as she popped the battery. Then she pulled a thickly quilted craft bag out from under the bed and swept the phones and batteries into it, then closed it and shoved it in a bedside drawer.
I don't think they could have done an in and out here while we were gone. Wouldn't bet on it in future, though. So I think we're alone now. Just us and the stars above. Like back when we were in camp.
Rita shivered. They'd been in the same Girl Scout troop, sent to the same weird summer camp down in Maryland, with other girls whose folks had serious faces and didn't talk about what they did. You know, we were nearly the only girls there whose parents didn't work in Spook City. Spook City was the huge, formerly NSA-only compound at Fort Meade, where the CIA and a bunch of other secret agencies had moved after 7/16. It had taken her years to figure that out. Why she and Angie and a couple of others had perpetually felt like they didn't quite fit in.
Little lone wolves, Kurt had jokingly called them when Rita told him about it.
Of course, Angie sniffed. I just want to be able to talk to you without the NSA on the party line.
It was an old joke. We're the NSA. We love to listen. We're the only branch of government that does. Alternative version.
We're the phone company. We don't listen. We don't have to. We've got the NSA to do it for us.
She placed a hand on Rita's shoulder.
Do you need help, Rita?
I need... Rita licked her lips. No, I don't think there's anything you could do to help. Not right now. No, wait, yes, there is. She reached out awkwardly, groping for Angie's shoulders. I had no idea you were here, or that you still wanted me.
A happy accident.
Angie pulled her close and nuzzled up against her neck.
Stay with me?
Always. Rita clung to her, a drowning woman who had just discovered a life raft. And this time I mean it. Philadelphia, Timeline 2, August 2020. Angie lived in a one-bedroom condo on the outskirts of Philly, in a suburb that was fitfully trying to redevelop. Rita spent the weekend with her, happier than she had been in years. The apartment was sparsely furnished. Angie's parents hadn't quite disowned her when she came out, but things had been tense. With the GI Bill benefits paying her way through her night school classes and electrician's apprenticeship, she'd scrimped and saved every spare dime to pay off the mortgage early. The walls were mostly bare, except for the framed certificates holding Angie's electrician's license and her honorable discharge, private first class, 704th Military Intelligence Brigade. There was a stack of old dead tree books in the bathroom. Rita was amused by the discovery that the sole reading matter they had in common consisted of dog-eared copies of The Grasshopper Lies Heavy and a handful of government security manuals. On Saturday night, Angie insisted on glamming up with Rita and taking her clubbing. On Sunday morning, they lay in, Rita aching from unaccustomed exertion. There was a bittersweet edge to it.
I'm not sure how much longer I'm going to be on assignment here, Rita told her. We'll sort something out.
Angie leaned against the headboard.
You don't get to escape again, girl.
Her grin was wicked, inviting complicity.
What were we thinking?
We were thinking guilty thoughts and trying not to get caught making out. Typical fucked up teenagers. Rita squinted, casting a judgmental gaze upon her earlier self.
I don't know if we would have clicked if we'd tried dating back then. Too young. Too much external pressure. I had a bunch of growing up to do.
Also, she shrugged, it gets better.
You've changed for the better, too. Angie tugged her close. I can't believe you were single.
Like I said, I had a bad breakup. Then the whole DHS thing happened. I was being single, and then I was being kept busy.
Do you still feel single?
Angie asked, and kissed her slowly.
No,
Rita said when she caught her breath again. I don't feel single.
My girl,
Angie giggled briefly.
Yeah,
Rita said fondly and tangled her fingers in Angie's hair. A thought struck her.
Listen, just do me a favor and don't change your relationship status on FB just yet.
Angie froze.
I mean, not yet, not in public. People are watching. I've got a feeling.
Have I been misreading this?
No.
But my, employers might.
Listen, how about the day after tomorrow? Wait that long? So I can report the contact? So they don't think I'm hiding anything? Otherwise, they might think it's a security infraction.
Angie unwound very slightly. Your employers are bastards.
Some of them are fundamentalists. The spooks love that kind of straight-arrow Puritan programming. I am not exaggerating. Only a few years ago, they'd have been telling me I'd burn in a rather hot place for this, or require an extra-strong course of aversion therapy or something. If they were following their church's doctrines, that is. Most of them aren't that crazy, but you can never tell.
She kissed Angie again.
So, like, because of security, I've got to report this, but I've got to be discreet. Don't be surprised if you're doorstepped by a couple of MIB in the next week or two. Background checks?
I'll pass.
Angie made a wave-off gesture.
Remember the twitch-your-toes trick for spoofing polygraphs? I'm current. Anyway, she smirked. I can always mistake them for Mormon missionaries, can't I?
You, Rita sighed. I should be getting back. Are you sure you can't stay longer?
No, like I said, I'm on call from midnight. Like being on watch. I have to go back to my hotel room before then or I'll turn into a pumpkin or something.
I'll run you over then.
Would you be a dear and do that?
Of course I'd do that.
And listen, if they give you any time off midweek, you call me, you hear?
I hear you.
Mm-hmm.
Rita leaned close and kissed her again.
And that status update?
I'm going to update mine on Tuesday.
Philadelphia. Timeline 2. August 2020.
Rita got back to the hotel at 11:30. As she entered the lobby arm-in-arm with Angie, she spotted Sonia Gomez sitting on a sofa at one side, reading something on her fat phone. As Gomez glanced up, Rita turned and squeezed Angie's hand, then gave her a swift peck on one cheek.
I'll be in touch, she whispered.
Who's she?
Angie asked tensely.
My problem, not yours. Internal security. Go home now. Thanks for everything.
Rita waited for Angie to leave before she approached Gomez, with a spring in her step that the agent's sour expression couldn't banish. Gomez, for her part, didn't meet Rita's eyes, but instead focused on Angie's departing back.
Well, isn't that a special piece? Got one in every port, have we?
Fuck you too, Rita thought, but kept the words to herself. I'll be updating my relationship status the day after tomorrow. Rita gave her a shit-eating grin. Or is having fun against your religion?
You didn't check in.
Gomez hissed like an angry cat, positively bristling.
I carried my phone, didn't I?
And the colonel's little helpers could have told you who I was talking to and exactly where I was at any time.
That's not the point.
Gomez's fingers curled.
Fuck. You don't get it, do you? Come on.
She grabbed Rita's elbow, gripping it painfully, and marched her toward the elevator. You may not be needed over the weekend, but you do not go off base during... Fuck you! Patrick told me to take a weekend leave.
Rita shook her arm free and glared at Gomez. Patrick!
Gomez glared back at her.
I'm going to follow this up.
He shouldn't have. If you were needed at short notice, if anything happened while you were putting out like a two-bit hooker, you'd have been sent to fetch me, wouldn't you? Rita pulled her arm away.
I was in Philly, Sonia, catching up with... I hadn't fled the country. I have a life, you know.
Could have fooled me up till now, Gomez muttered under her breath. The elevator stopped.
Come on. Briefing's on in 20 minutes. The colonel's come here specially to see you. Wipe that smirk off your face.
Rita's face was still stretched in a rictus grin when they approached one of the hotel conference rooms. The rest of the conference floor seemed curiously empty, bereft of weekend sales conventions and the like, but they'd passed a handful of armed DHS cops on their way.
What's going on here, Sonia? Did he book the whole hotel?
Yes, he did. Are you beginning to see where this is going yet?
Mushroom, remember?
Rita waggled a couple of fingers in the air.
You keep me in the dark and feed me shit, you can't expect me to make a positive contribution.
Well, try not to fuck up, child. It's not just the colonel today, and these guys play at the high stakes tables.
Rita looked at Gomez sharply. You know what? I'd be more inclined to listen to your advice if you didn't do such a good job of hating on me.
Gomez snorted. It's not you I hate. She gestured at the closed conference room door ahead. Go right on in. The lions are hungry and waiting. I'll be back for you with a mop and a body bag when they call me.
The door led into a large conference suite with an outer office. Patrick was waiting there.
Had a good weekend? He asked.
Yeah. Rita found it impossible to keep a smile off her face. Thanks for the time off.
Is she an old friend or a new one?
He stood up. We were in the Girl Scouts together.
Rita forced her expression back to bland.
What's this about? What's going on?
Patrick paused with his hand on the inner door. Everything blew up about 6 hours ago. Until then, it was hurry up and wait. Now, he shrugged. You ready?
His glance reminded Rita that she wasn't exactly dressed for the office. Hair tousled, clothes casual.
They'll just have to take me as they find me, she said, her assumed levity only half false. Good. Patrick ushered her in. Hello, Rita.
The colonel smiled like he was putting a brave face on a toothache. There were a couple of other men around the table, overformal in black suits with small gold lapel pin crosses. Recalling her conversation with Angie, they reminded Rita of Mormon missionaries, except they were too old and senior for that. Their body language showed a subtle deference toward the third interloper. She was a middle-aged woman, her wavy dark hair sprinkled with gray. Rita would have pegged her as an HR manager first, or an accountant second, but for the escort.
Uh-oh, she thought, as Patrick pulled out a chair and motioned for her to sit.
Is there a problem? She asked quietly.
Yes, but you're not it.
The colonel's smile was unreassuring.
Okay, I'm not in trouble yet, but he's about to throw me in it.
It's nearly midnight, she pointed out. I thought we were going for Tuesday?
Yes, well, so did I.
She caught Colonel Smith's brief sidelong glance at the woman.
Rita, I'd like you to meet Dr. Eileen Scranton. Dr. Scranton is the Deputy Assistant to the Secretary of State for Homeland Security.
Pleased to meet you, Doctor,
Rita managed to say without stuttering. Scranton smiled back, graciously.
Likewise, I'm sure.
Eileen is in my immediate reporting chain, two levels up, the colonel added.
Two levels up from Major General Equivalent, Rita translated internally. What does that even mean?
She reports in turn to the Homeland Security Council, and thanks to the miracle of matrix management, to the National Security Council. The HSC being DHS and the NSC being the Defense Department.
Rita tried not to hyperventilate. Where does the president come into all this? She had a horrible feeling that the ladder of government didn't have much headspace above the Homeland Security Council. Suddenly, Gomez's paranoid live wire act was looking less like an overreaction and more like justifiable caution.
I'm honored. What can I do for you, Doctor?
For me, personally, nothing. Eileen smiled self-deprecatingly. She glanced at Colonel Smith. I'm just sitting in as a monitor, ensuring that the Homeland Security Council and National Security Council are fully informed.
Informed by a first-person witness, Rita decoded. In case the colonel is an inaccurate correspondent.
Smith looked as relaxed as he ever did, which corresponded to somewhere between overcaffeinated and hitting the crystal meth, in normal person terms. But he certainly didn't look stressed out or upset, as he might if his superiors were investigating him for running a rogue operation.
We've become something of a sensation over the weekend.
The colonel smiled tightly at her.
The Secretary of State was briefed on Saturday, and on Sunday we made headlines in a very small way. On the President's daily brief.
Rita swallowed, queasily nervous. That document was more usually preoccupied by Chinese nuclear battle group maneuvers in the Yellow Sea, or the geopolitical consequences of fluctuations in the price of natural gas in Europe, than by the 15-minute foray of an agent blundering around a railway switchyard in the dark. To Rita, who'd grown up carefully keeping her head down, making it onto the daily brief felt wrong.
Dr. Scranton is here to ensure that the White House is kept fully informed.
Rita dry swallowed. This was like something out of a bad Hollywood adventure game.
Okay, I guess. I'll do my best.
She realized her mouth was in danger of running away from her, and forced it into silence.
We're still on for 0300 hours on Tuesday. Smith added. Patrick, do you want to take it away? Yeah.
Rita took heart. Patrick was putting a good face on it, but she knew him well enough now to recognize the small signs. He was at least as unnerved as she was.
Our current mission plan repeats and extends the Mission 1 baseline from Thursday last, adding additional elements that extend the sortie duration to 2 hours. As before, there will be go-no-go checkpoints and emergency exits at each staging point. The objectives are to revalidate safe insertion protocol, check for signs of adversary awareness, collect uplink data from distributed surveillance nodes, then insert additional surveillance devices.
One of the suits who'd blown in with Dr. Scranton raised a hand as soon as Patrick paused.
How exactly are you going to check signs of activity on the part of an adversary you have not yet characterized?
Rita stifled a groan. It's going to be one of those meetings, she realized.
Not so much micromanaged as nano-managed. Every footfall to be structured for maximum carefully contrived defensive ass covering on the part of the stakeholders. Her unique status as the only Jaunt Blue operative meant that everybody was simultaneously shit-scared of losing her and eager to put their own grubby fingerprints all over the intelligence assessment that would be read by the woman in the Oval Office. It was simultaneously fascinating and tedious, like sitting in on one of Haptotech's marketing meetings before the trade show. Only Clive would have fired the fingerprint hounds on the spot.
I should have stayed over with Angie, Rita realized.
Except that, as an opportunity to be a fly on the wall at an intel operation that had just leveled up to boss, this was unbeatable. Historic, even. The other girls at spy camp would have been slack-jawed with envy. And so would their parents.
Philadelphia, Timeline 2. Iron Gate, Timeline 3. August, 2020.
It was nearly 3 a.m, and a light rain was falling when Rita climbed out of the trailer, actually a TV production unit's mobile dressing room that someone had sprung for, and clumped over to the taped-out transfer location. Her back sagged under the weight of all the crap the committee had insisted she carry. This is just nuts, she thought. Tired and irritable, she wished she were brave enough to throw a quiet tantrum. Sunday night's meeting had bled over into the small hours of Monday morning, then reconvened over coffee and cronuts at 2 in the afternoon, then run on again until 8. This deprived her of the chance to do more than catch a quick shower and call Angie. Just for the blind reassurance of hearing her voice, a tangible reminder that she hadn't imagined her life taking an extraordinary swerve for the better. She also managed to fit in an hour-long nap, one troubled by disturbing dreams of abandonment. Upon waking, the surreal sense of disconnection resumed. "Why am I even here?" she asked herself. "Why can't I just take the week off?" The emotional flash flood, pouring across the rock-hard plain of a life baked by months of drought, made concentrating on what she was supposed to be doing almost impossible. She was besieged by the resurrected ghosts of unquiet memories, hiking together on the Appalachian Trail, lying awake at night in a crowded tent, listening to the girl next to her slowly breathing and wondering. For Mission 2, there were 3 times as many bodies clogging up the parking lot and getting in the way, most of them apparently bag carriers for rubbernecking bosses who couldn't force themselves to let well enough alone and allow the people who knew what they were doing to get on with the job, which was basically her, with Patrick for instructions and the DHS armorers and sysadmins for tech support. The colonel had come along to keep a nervous eye on the teeter-tottering hierarchs who had descended from above, as if to watch the launch of a new long-range missile or something. People in expensive suits kept bugging Rita to talk to them, made her repeat herself endlessly until her cheeks were tight from nervous smiling. Even that bitch Sonia Gomez was trying to make nice in her direction. And the floodlights! Rita finally cracked. "Will somebody kill those floodlights, please?" 6 mobile telescoping masts with lights on them lit up the parking lot so bright that Rita was beginning to feel the need for sunblock. One of the rubberneckers called, "We need them for the cameras. They're going to ruin my night vision." Colonel Smith heard her plea and took mercy.
"You heard her. Everybody get ready for lights out at T-minus 5 minutes. She needs to adapt to darkness before showtime. Who's in charge of lighting? You, yes, you. I want the floods out. Out at T-minus 5, all of them."
The lights began to dim, fading finally to a pointillist sparkle of isolated LEDs that simulated moonlight. It was still too bright, Rita fretted, but her eyes were beginning to adapt.
"Are you okay?" Patrick asked quietly from behind her. "Anything you need?"
"Yes, get rid of the circus," she thought.
"There are too many people here. Isn't that a security issue?"
"Yeah, I'll have a word with the colonel. If we're lucky, he can convince Dr. Scranton to lock it down again after this run. But she's under a lot of pressure from stakeholders who want to get an eyeful of the promised land."
Hoodoo? I mean, what? Why? Promised land? Patrick looked bone-tired.
"The Mormons and the Scientologists are duking it out again. They'll take any excuse. You just have to roll with it. Can I get you anything else? Can of Pepsi?"
"I don't want to need a restroom while I'm out there. Have a coffee waiting for me and debrief when I get back."
"Good girl."
He patted her shoulder, misjudging the weight of her pack, and she staggered.
"Oops. Try not to, break a leg."
"Check."
"T-minus 1 minute,"
some idiot intoned into a bullhorn, fancying himself the ringmaster. Rita flipped her night viz goggles down, then squeezed her left forearm carefully.
"Oh, Angie," she thought.
Please let it not just be my imagination that you...
30 seconds! She forced herself back into focus.
Lifelogger go to maximum bandwidth, record everything and journal to backpack, she muttered into her throat mic. Over. Then she jaunted, twice in rapid succession. This time she thought she knew what to expect of the rail yard. So she kept her balance, swung her helmet-mounted glasses round in a circle to take in the tracks, recording everything like a good Girl Scout. There were trains, but none of them were moving. Dim starlight gleamed off a distant fence. A faint breeze raised whispers in the overhead wires, and the station buildings formed indistinct black silhouettes on the far side of the tracks. Headset, new capture map, bookmark current. She squatted, then hit the release on her backpack. A hefty Pelly case thudded to the ground behind her. She turned, squatted, and flipped it open. Dim LEDs began to blink as the data logger began to ping the scattered surveillance devices she'd planted before the weekend. Now she opened the flap covering the other half of the case. 4 gunmetal bird shapes nestled within like legless, beakless pigeons with synthetic sapphire eyes, Raytheon birds that laid Rockwell eggs. She lifted them one at a time, unplugged their charge cables, and ran through the checklist on her head-up display, then stood back as they spread their carbon fiber wings and lofted into the night. Once the micro UAVs had flown, Rita did another 360 turn. There was nobody in sight. It was as quiet as a graveyard. She flipped the Pelly case closed, then armed the dead man's switch. If all went to plan, she'd pick it up on her return journey. If not, it had a world-walking armband unit of its own and would jaunt home in 2 hours. Set timer to 1 hour 45. She didn't like to think about what they would do if the base station went home without her. She tried to ask Colonel Smith, but he'd flatly changed the subject, not even bothering to evade.
You know better than to ask questions like that.
He'd looked pained, as if she'd turned up to a test without studying for it. She'd swallowed. You know I'll come home on schedule unless for some reason I can't. Aren't you supposed to offer me a cyanide capsule or something, in case I'm captured and tortured?
You won't be, he said,
with calm reassurance that in retrospect gave her the cold shivers. We're monitoring you via the telemetry return module and your wearable diagnostics, the harness of electrodes taped to her skin under her clothes. If you glimpse someone, you jaunt home. If you fall and break a leg, you jaunt home. If someone shoots at you, you jaunt home. If the locals capture you, and they won't if you've done the other things right, you jaunt home. Your only excuse for not jaunting home is that you're dead, in which case the Jaunt Blue program is suspended. The question of what happens after that is one for the National Security Council. It's not my job or yours to second-guess them. Casting around with her grainy, noise-speckled green starlight scopes, Rita discerned no signs of motion. Looking down, she stepped across the first track, knelt, and used the right angle and laser range finder from her right thigh pocket to measure the interrail gap. 5 feet 2 inches precisely. Keeping her feet on the stony ballast between the sleepers, avoiding contact with the rails, she made her way across the switchyard toward the darkened signal house. Hulking transformers buzzed quietly in a fenced-in cantonment not far from the building, stacked insulators feeding fat cables up to an overhead gantry. Smell of damp wood, oil and ozone, distant trees. Odor of dirt, a slight sulfurous tickle at the back of the throat. An external wooden staircase ran up to the entrance to the signal box on the second floor. It was built of red brick, stained black with soot, and the paint around the window frames was peeling. She scanned her environs again, then carefully checked the wall outside the signal box.
telegraph wires led under the eaves. Or maybe they were low-voltage power cables, not the heavy traction current from the substation behind the fence. But there were no obvious signs of external alarms. The door at the top of the stairs was wooden, paneled, and secured with a bulky hasp and padlock.
"This isn't a forerunner timeline," she said quietly, trusting the telemetry return module to capture her words for posterity. "Use of wood, brick, and natural materials. It's closer to..."
There was a sign by the side of the signal box door. Without thinking, she climbed the steps until she was close enough to read it. It was made of embossed metal. Rust spots showed through the enameled paint surface.
"Sign in English. Lifelogger. Bookmark this."
She peered closer. "Eastern Imperial Permanent Way Rules and Regulations. Employees only. Trespassers will be attainedered. Maximum penalty, squiggle 50/- excitement.
"I can read this. They speak English."
Sort of, vied with disappointment.
"Oh, I can read this. It's just English."
She hadn't brought a lockpick kit, and she wasn't proficient enough to waste time fumbling around in the dark with a padlock on a semi-derelict-looking building. She contented herself by gumming a webcam up against one of the panes of glass in the door, where it would have a decent view of everyone working in the building by daylight, and the glass could act as a resonant surface for its mic. Then she descended the stairs and made for the platform with the station office, four tracks away. Her blood was humming in her ears. Quick, darting glances told her she was still alone. The station building was a long, low, single-story structure with a gently sloping roof, sitting on a raised platform island between two tracks. It was clearly designed for passenger trains. Rita guessed its length at about 500 feet, short by U.S. standards per the briefing from the FRA guy.
"Do they use it to bring in the switchyard crew?" she wondered.
"Or do they run short commuter trains? Daylight and webcams would tell." She duck-walked along the track bed, checking for signs of activity in the building, then climbed the steps at the end of the platform. It was the work of a minute to climb atop some kind of low retaining wall sized for trolleys or supplies, and to stick a couple of webcams to one of the supports of the long station canopy. Then she worked her way along the platform. Rita came to what looked to be a waiting room or ticket office, shuttered against the night. There were posters on the wall outside in glass-fronted frames, just like a station at home. There was a timetable. She scanned it carefully at close range, trusting that the list of unfamiliar destinations would be meaningful to some back-office analyst. Other public information notices. She forced herself to glance at them quickly but not allow herself to become absorbed. Some were strikingly familiar, as if they were a glimpse of home as seen through a semantic funhouse mirror. "Democracy is endangered. If you see something, tell someone." That could almost have come from home. But then she came to another. "Long live the revolution. Equality, democracy, liberty." And below it, in smaller lettering, "Down with royalism."
Hang on, she thought, her perspective expanding dizzyingly. The rusting sign on the signal box door, it had said something about an imperial permanent way. And now this,
"Down with royalism." What does it mean? She came to another locked platform door beside a window. And for once, the window wasn't shuttered. It was an office, looking out on the platform. Rita peeped inside. There was no sign of life. With her low-powered flashlight, she lit up the room within until her night glasses could see clearly. Barely a single lumen sufficed. There were swivel chairs of heavy wood and brass with leather seats and green metal-topped desks. File cabinets loomed against one wall. A tall electric fan with villainously sharp-looking blades hulked over the largest desk like a frozen mantis. The desk was crowded, with several in-trays and an old-school computer. Pay dirt, she realized, and climbed atop a platform bench seat to affix another webcam to the glass, looking in. Then she glanced down at the desk and realized what she had seen, but not registered. There was a computer on the desk. It was an old-school bulky beige box with a metal cover, not a tablet or a flat display panel. A keyboard you could club someone to death with sat proudly in the middle of the blotter, but something about it didn't look quite right. She fumbled for a moment with her webbing, then managed to pull out the super zoom camera. "Come on, damn you," she muttered under her breath. The autofocus didn't want to work in darkness. She glanced around, nervously, then switched the flash to automatic and squeezed her eyes shut as she depressed the shutter button. Then she zoomed in on the image she'd captured. It was a keyboard, all right, but the key layout was all wrong. The keys weren't staggered. There were too many columns and not enough rows. "I guess we're not in QWERTY City anymore," she told herself. She was still boggling at the museum exhibits when the platform light came on.